Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Welcome to episode 28 of the Rex Chapman Show with super cool, super awesome Josh Hopkins. Josh is not with us today. Bit of a family issue. He'll be back soon. Episode 28. Let's see. Marshall Faulk is a number 28 from way back in the day. I don't know many 28s. Tony Delt from I believe he wore 28 with the Celtics once. Sounds about right. We have a really good guest today that I'm excited about. Get into it in a minute. It's our third Dookie, and I don't know that I can stomach another Dookie, but I'm gonna try. Talk about the NBA for a minute. The Bulls are fun. They're like the most fun team in the league to watch right now for me. They all can pass. They all can shoot. They get up and down the floor. Alex Caruso balling, Lonzo Ball balling. My goodness, they're fun to watch. And that's been cool. It's been fun to see the Wizards on top of things. What? The Wizards? The Bullets / Wizards? My Bullets? Fun to see them. They gave up a lot. Or they gave up Russ to get back a bunch of players. And those bunch of players are playing their asses off. The Warriors, let's go Dubs, right? We missed the Warriors, and doing all this without Clay, I'm sure when Clay comes back, they'll go through some growing pains while he's coming back into rhythm. But my goodness, Jordan Poole playing his ass off. Stephen Curry, Steph's the MVP, right? Yeah, he's the MVP. All right, well, let's get to it. Let's get to episode 28. And today we've had Jeff Capel on, a Dookie. We've had JJ Redick on, also a Dookie. Today we have Seth Davis. Seth Davis, my friend Seth Davis from CBS Sports, to join us for episode 28. Let's get to it. Seth Lewis Davis, CBS college basketball analyst, reporter, senior college hoops writer for The Athletic, author of Wooden, A Coach's Life, Getting to Us, and When March Went Mad. Welcome, Seth. Thanks for joining me, buddy. It's like I talk to you every day.
I know. What's up, Rexy Poo? This is like, is this going to be your revenge on me for like all those years of posting you up with questions? Like now you get to turn the tables on me.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. We did see one another last week. It was good seeing you, bud, in New York for the ball game.
What ball game are we talking about, by the
way? We're talking about
Duke. Get a result of that game? I don't follow college basketball that closely.
Yeah, so. I know you don't. We got a result. You guys beat us. Duke, Kentucky in the Garden. What a great atmosphere.
Oh, man.
Right?
Oh, it was great. And then, you know, I was in Pauley Pavilion on Friday for UCLA Villanova.
That was amazing.
It was a great game and a great environment. And, you know, I'm not sure other sports or people who follow and cover other sports appreciate the PTSD that college basketball went through last season, because college basketball is the only sport, major sport, that got canceled. Right. The NBA, they finished out their playoffs in the bubble. The NHL, they got their Stanley Cup. Baseball started late. They got their World Series. The 2020 tournament was canceled like 2 days before Selection Sunday and never to return. So when the season started last year, aside from not having fans in there, which was rough enough, it was like everybody was in this rickety old house looking at the roof thinking, when is this thing going to cave in? You know, when are they going to cancel the season? Disruptions and postponements. So now the season has started and fans are in and we seem to be in a pretty good place. We're not necessarily worried about games getting canceled. I don't want to jinx anything. But it's good. It's really, it just refreshes. I'm always grateful, Rex. You know that. I have a spirit of gratitude about me. And I think a lot of people around the sport feel that, especially acutely right now.
No question. I mean, just being in that building in New York the other night, I was a little, I've been to a lot of Kentucky games, a lot of Kentucky Duke games, and I've been to some in the Garden. You guys definitely had us outnumbered fan-wise. Did you not?
Yes, of course. In my role as a journalist, I, you know, I'm not a you guys guy, but no.
But did you feel that? Did you say that?
I don't know that I felt that. No, okay. I think maybe you're just used to Kentucky having the most fans no matter where they play. That's why I love.
Well, that's what I'm talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah, yeah. No, Duke is very popular. No, Duke is actually a small school. When I went, I graduated in 1992, a million years ago, the undergrad enrollment was like 6,000, which I came from a pretty small private school. I thought that was big. But now that like this process with my son applying to schools, I realize how small that is. So it's not like a Kentucky, Ohio State, North Carolina. We have this huge alumni base.
Yeah.
But it's pretty, nationally have a
pretty nice base in New York, right?
I would say a lot of fans, people who are just Duke fans. Okay. Ironically, it's inside the state of North Carolina where Duke is the least popular, which is.
My mind went straight to. You got to be vaccinated to be in the Garden.
So therefore, fewer Kentucky fans, maybe.
I don't know.
Duke's pretty popular in the Garden. Popular in the Garden.
So, you have to see that game. Oh, by the way, I got to say, you know, I was talking to the guys, the crew before you came on, and every now and then you see a basketball player that really excites you. And, you know, seeing as many players as we're fortunate enough to see, you know, on not only watching on television, but get to interview and watch in person. I get really excited when there's something different. And the kid Boncaro for Duke, that guy, he's unique. He's so big. Like, you know, Kentucky had the kid Oscar Tshiebwe. 6'8", 6'9", long, you know, had a great game against Duke. But Boncaro is a good 2.5 inches taller than him. I mean, he's sick. He's a good 6'10", and just a mountain of a guy. His skill level is unbelievable. The fact that he can handle the ball. You know, I talked to a couple of guys, a couple of scouts there that are still Duke. They're Dukies. And they were telling me, you know, they saw him this summer, weren't so sure. they're believers now. And Keel's obviously an amazing player. But the bodies on those two young men to be 18-year-olds, are they as good as advertised?
Yeah, well, Boncaro, certainly. You know, I didn't really get to see them much in high school, not as much on the recruiting trail as I used to be. So I'm always a little bit skeptical.
Yeah.
Now I had seen Zion. So, but I was also a little skeptical about Zion just because, like, I sort of feel like at a certain level, you can overpower your opponents physically. And that happens a lot with guys in high school, especially the bigger players. But then when you move up a level, now you have to really be able to play. And as we know that Zion was really able to play. And that's what I see in Boncaro. I think it's very hard to think of a proper player analogy for him. I mean, Derek Coleman comes to mind, I think, physically, but Derek never had that ball skill. Certainly as a freshman, he actually reminded me in the Duke family a lot of Grant Hill. The difference being, first of all, Grant as a freshman, and I was a junior when Grant was a freshman, Grant did not have that jump shooting ability, but right. Even more importantly, he didn't have the mentality. I mean, Grant came in like everybody else, petrified of Leitner, deferential to the older guys. It wasn't until Grant Hill was a senior at Duke that he would legitimately walk onto the court and feel like I'm the baddest dude in this gym. So the fact that Paolo has that already was just super impressive, and they're going to ride them. They're not a real deep team, number one. And number two, I'm concerned about their three-point shooting. I think you've got to be a really good three-point shooting team to succeed in college basketball. Otherwise, it's like playing 5-on-4. So some question marks there, but you could make the case that he's the best player. I know Drew Timmy had a great game, obviously, against Texas. But, like, if you had to win a game tomorrow and you could only pick one of those two guys as your first guy, who would you take?
Oh, man. Boncaro, but you can just envision him. You can put him in a game right now, in an NBA game right now. That's the thing about the NBA game, is it's just so much more physical, and the guys are bigger and stronger. And most guys come in, especially as 19-year-olds, and have to figure it out for a while physically. When you can go in and already compete physically, and he can, Keels can. I mean, those are grown men at 18. So I want to kind of go out west though with you. You saw that game at Pauley Pavilion, and I've only been there maybe 3 or 4 times in my life, and I've never been there when UCLA was really good. And like, because I know what it was like, or I think I know what it was like when they were so good back in the day. And I remember they won a title, you know, it's been a while back now, but it's like the passion is back. And they hired Mick Cronin, which Mick's a Cincy guy. And I know Mick even when they hired him, I was like, ooh, I don't know if Mick will work there. They love him, don't they?
Well, they love him when he wins, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's funny how that works. I mean, Ben Howland went to 3 straight Final Four.
Right, right.
They liked him, and then he wasn't doing so well. You know, they fired Ben Howland after he won the Pac-12 regular season title. I guess it was Pac-10 at that point. So it's a little bit of a weird dynamic with UCLA fans, to be honest. Obviously, it's a subject I'm deeply familiar with, having researched the Wooden Book, and now I've been living out in Los Angeles for almost 9 years. I want to say 8 years. I haven't been to a ton of games in Pauley. Normally when I go up there, it's for practices and interviews and whatnot, but I've been to enough and been around the fans enough where they have really high expectations. As everybody knows, they only hang the banners, championships. There's no Final Four banners. There's no conference title banners. It's only national championship banners. And the reality is there's a lot to do in LA. It's great weather. The traffic is really tough, and they're in like ground zero for traffic where Westwood is. Yeah. So they don't get like great crowds at a lot of their games, and they don't get energetic crowds. That's what I was referencing about Kentucky fans. You know, people give them a lot of grief because they're so nutso, but you could put a Kentucky game in Siberia and you'd have 10,000 people there wearing blue, and they do their part.
Right.
UCLA basketball fans are a little bit more fickle than that. But I will say that Final Four run last year, the fact that it came on a team that nobody expected it. They had been in the first four. I mean, they were the last team called literally on the selection show. For them to go to the final, I think it's the first time they've been to a Final Four as that kind of an underdog. And I do think that people are really excited about that and the fact that they're bringing everybody back. And, you know, Mick is bringing that Cincinnati Bearcat mentality to a group that has a lot more talent than he ever coached at Cincinnati. And he's recruiting great. People want to play for him. He's building a culture. He's able to recruit a caliber student athlete coming from really strong families who come back to, you know, he didn't have anybody in the transfer portal. So he may have too many players that he knows what to do with, and that's a good problem to have. So yeah, it was just really cool to see Pauley jumping like that. And then the game even out-delivered all the hype, which was the best part.
The Rex Chapman Show, powered by Basketball News, is sponsored by Prize Picks. Prize Picks is the easy way to play daily fantasy. It's daily fantasy simplified. It's just you versus the projected numbers. You can pick from 2 up to 5 players and an over-under on their projected stats for a single game and win up to 10 times on any entry. Prize Picks is safe and offers fast withdrawals. Prize Picks allows mixed sports entries, offering every sport you can think of, NBA, college basketball, the NFL, soccer, MMA, and more. Your Prize Picks entries can be made in 60 seconds or less. It's that easy. You can take the over on LeBron's points combined with the over on Patrick Mahomes' passing yards if you want. You can receive a match on your deposits up to $100 using our exclusive promo code NEWS. That's promo code NEWS for an instant 100% deposit match on up to $100. Prize Picks has an award-winning, easy-to-use mobile app available in the App Store and Google Play. You did a piece recently on Johnny Juzang, and I was fortunate to interview him when he was here at Kentucky as a player his freshman year. Didn't play a lot, didn't have a lot of success, transferred. Talk to me about your conversation and your interview with Johnny and his family. I know they're a fascinating crew.
Yeah, they're a fascinating crew. And I'm always interested in, you know, having done this with you several times, deconstructing people, breaking them down into little pieces, and then putting it all back together and seeing how all the pieces fit. And, you know, you have a father who grew up in Louisiana with a Creole dad and a Black mom and some Native American ancestry, is a grandmother who was Native American, marries a woman from Vietnam who has some Chinese and French in her blood, grew up in Vietnam with Vietnamese parents. And in that great mix, you have unbelievable family. Besides, we see what Johnny is doing is, you know, arguably a first team All-American right now, might be the second best player on his own team. Right. As his plan, but his older brother, Christian, played for Harvard, graduated from Harvard, and is now doing really cool things. And then they have a younger sister, Lauren, is a freshman at Syracuse who's already making music and singing and has songs up on Spotify, and she's like the star of the bunch. So I kept asking the parents, like, what are you guys doing? I love my boys, but I mean, that's pretty impressive. So, you know, Johnny Juzang didn't just plop in a Poly Pavilion and start playing the way that he played. And you mentioned that Kentucky experience, and that's really interesting because I think, to me, on the one hand, it's regrettable because, as you know, he reclassified as a high school senior. He was already 1 year older, so he reclassified back into his age group, unlike, say, Amani Bates, who's not going to turn 18 till January. And he went to Kentucky and didn't play much and maybe kind of was asked to play in a way as more of a catch-and-shoot guy. But, I mean, Calipari had Tyrese Maxey, right? I mean, what, you're not playing behind, you know, Schmendricks here. So, to me, it's regrettable in that he didn't get to finish out his senior year. He didn't have a prom. He didn't get to have a real graduation from high school. I think a lot of times kids are in a rush, but it was something that Johnny wanted to do. His parents weren't crazy about it, but they were able to give him that space to make his own decision, which means when it didn't go as well as expected, he had to own that and not look at his dad and say, well, you made me do this. Right. And so when I asked him about it, he said, hey, it was a great experience. It was adversity. Like, this kid is old for his age, and it's that wisdom and perspective for him to get. Now, he came back and he transferred back home. Kentucky got a lot more settled, and I think COVID, you know, kind of messed everything for everybody. And he's obviously thriving now, but it's not like he looks back on that and says it was a mistake just because he didn't get a lot of minutes. He appreciates the experience and the going through the adversity and the competition that he got. And that's why he's going to be successful, whatever he wants to do in the long run, because he sees that bigger picture.
That's exactly the experience, or almost exactly the experience I had with him interviewing him. I was interviewing each young man, you know, 30 minutes at a time. They just came in throughout the day for the preseason, you know, kind of a video thing for UK basketball. And Johnny came in barefoot, LA kid, everybody else, you know, in their sweats and stuff. He came in barefoot. And one of the questions I was asking them, each one, was, you know, if you couldn't play basketball, if there were no sports, what would you do? What would you be, you know, what do you think you would do? And, you know, if somebody would have asked me that, I'd have been like, I don't know, is putt-putt a sport? You know, but he's the only one that came right back with an answer. He said, I'd be a Navy SEAL. And I was like, he'd given it thought. You know, you mentioned his brother played at Harvard. What a unique family. Well done to his folks and relatives, right?
Yeah, it was cool. And I actually saw them. I had met the dad. We had lunch when I interviewed him for the story, but all the other interviews were over the phone. And then they were all there at the game on Friday. So I got to, in fact, I texted his dad because Johnny was like 2 for 10 in the first half. He was awful. So I texted his dad at halftime. I said, the good news is he cannot play any worse. And you just knew, and you were this kind of player, you know, a guy is too good to be that bad for that long. That it's
2 for 10.
You matter of time.
2 for 10. I might be on fire at 2 for 10. I don't even know yet.
He had that Ted Lasso goldfish, man. He just came out. And right. He actually hit a couple of buckets at the end of the half, and you knew he was going to go in with some confidence. So
he's a nice player. You brought up John Wooden. And you talked about deconstructing people and, you know, for your writing and whatnot. How daunting was that with John Wooden. I mean, there's nobody bigger in our sport and maybe in sports. But how daunting was that once he agreed to it? And how did that come about?
Well, interestingly enough, I wouldn't say that he agreed to it. So okay. I had interviewed him, and this is the dance that you play, that you do when you're writing books like this. I had interviewed him on three occasions over the course, I want to say of 7-8 years, and he was very accessible. So when I lived in Los Angeles the first time, this is back in 2001, when I got married, we lived here for 2 years, moved back east for 10, and then came back. And Ben Howland had just gotten hired at UCLA. And so I knew that John Wooden had breakfast at the same place every morning. And so I thought, you know, when you come to UCLA and you're the coach, obviously you have the specter and the pressure of John Wooden. You get the John Wooden legacy that you're never going to live up to. But you also get the actual John Wooden, who at the time was like 91, maybe 92. And you can talk to him and ask him questions and befriend him and soak up that experience. So that was what I wanted to capture. So I arranged to have breakfast at the diner with Coach Wooden and Coach Howland. Met them there thinking that was all. And I'm just going to write a column based on the conversation. And then when the breakfast was over, Coach said, well, you guys want to come back to my place and we'll chat some more. And I said, wow, that's great. So Ben knew, and it was right around the corner. Ben knew how to, but I didn't know how to go back there. So Coach Wooden rode in my car. So I'm petrified. I'm like, if I do something wrong here, the world's going to hate me, right? I'm like, he was great. And we sat in his den for a while, and then Ben had to go. And I stayed for another couple hours while Coach Wooden read poetry. He loved company. His mind, it really kept him alive for a long time and mentally sharp for a long time. So I did that a couple of more times where I met with him. And I just got to a point where I knew that there was a book there. Like people would say, you know, there've been so many books about John Wooden, you know, what's going to make yours different. And I just knew that there was a third dimension there. Everybody painted him as this two-dimensional figure, never had a bad day, never got criticized, never had any flaws, never did anything wrong. Not that I wanted to like take him down, I just wanted to humanize him. So by the time I got the contract to write the book, he was 99, I want to say. And so he passed just as I was really starting to work in earnest. And then, you know, frankly, Rex, regrettably, his two kids, Nan and Jim, and Nan just passed away, didn't want to cooperate and didn't want to have me interview. And I knew both of them pretty well. And I'm not sure why to this day, but to their great credit, they made no effort to shut me off from anybody else. And they could have made it very difficult. And anytime I would reach out to somebody, if they reached out to Nan, they would say, you do what you want. We're not saying talk. We're not saying don't talk. So it was very daunting, not least because the man lived to be almost 100. So the more research I did and the more I typed, the more I had to go. And there's kind of a metaphor for writing books and really for life, which is that, you know, writing a book is like driving at night. You can only see as far as your headlights, but if you keep going, you'll eventually get there. And it took me, you know, a good 4 years to get it done. And like I say, I wanted to be, you know, tough on him, but fair and gentle and loving and understanding. And, you know, I just never thought that writing about someone's flaws makes it negative. Why are you writing a negative? Well, I think trying to make a guy live up to this vision of sainthood is unfair to him. So, I'm pretty pleased. Actually, I wrote a column recently for The Athletic about some of the circumstances about Wood's retirement, and actually went back into the book and read a big chunk of it, which I hadn't done in a long time. I tend not to go back and read just because I got better things to do. But I have to say, I read this and I read the book and I thought it was pretty good. So it was just an unbelievable experience and very honored to be able to know him a little bit and tell his story in full.
I'm very, very grateful you did it. Anything stand out from that experience? Any story, anything stand out to you that maybe didn't make the book? I don't know.
Well, it was definitely in the book, but you know, it was interesting. And I just published a story last week. It's always interesting to take this, like John Wooden, besides the interviews that I got from him, gave me a great gift in that he was very available and did tons of interviews. So it wasn't hard for me to get a lot of his words that he, especially over the last 30 years of his life after he retired. And it's always interesting to hear the stories that he told when he was 90 and then go back to those actual times and figure out what really happened. And, you know, memory is a very, very tricky thing. And there are a lot of studies about memory and, you know, we can say things that aren't true and 100% say, well, you're a liar and you're a deceiver. No, 100% believe in your heart. This is what happened, but the memory just wasn't there. So, you know, there were a couple of things and I again, wrote this for last week because the season started and we had these retirements of Mike Krzyzewski and Roy Williams. One of the most interesting things that I discovered was, you know, John Wooden always told the story about how he decided that it was time to quit. And he always told the story, 1975 Final Four, they win in overtime, very emotional game against Louisville and your guy, Denny Crum, who was a former UCLA player and longtime assistant under John Wooden. And everyone assumed was going to be the next coach. And John Wooden tells a story that he was so drained from that game that as he's walking off the court, he didn't feel like I want to talk to the press. And it was the first time he had felt like that. And if I feel like this, it must be time to get out. And bang, spur of the moment, he decides to retire. And he tells his players and he tells the press and his wife is shocked. His assistants are shocked. His AD spends half the night. Well, come to find out, that's complete BS. Total BS. He decided, he almost retired the year before. Being on top like that took a lot out of him and he had a heart attack and his wife didn't like it and all the pressure was never enough. So at the beginning of the season, he told his boss, J.D. Morgan, this is my last year.
Wow.
They wanted to give the job to Gary Cunningham. Gary Cunningham, a couple months later, told J.D. Morgan, I don't want the job. And so J.D. Morgan didn't want to hire Denny Crum. He plucks Gene Bartow, who nobody had thought about. Gene Bartow flew to L.A. in February to meet with J.D. Morgan under the cloak of night and then was sort of close to accepting it. And Gene Bartow, God rest his soul, confided this to his good friend, George Raveling, who was the head coach at Washington State. And George Raveling, being a man of letters, also had a column that he wrote for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. So Raveling got the scoop. Before the tournament started, he said, John, this is going to be John Wood. It's already, he never mentioned Bartow and never gave up his source until he gave it up to me many years later. And
John Raveling broke the story.
George Raveling.
George Raveling. Are you serious?
Broke the story. Yeah, he would be Twitter here. And he was the coach in Wooden's conference. So J.D. Morgan called up Raveling. So, you know, Raveling tells me the story and Bob Boyd told me about how Wooden told him that I'm going to retire. And actually, Ted Owens, I was in New Orleans at a Final Four. I ran into Ted Owens, who was the coach of Kansas at the time. And I wanted to talk to him for the book and we were talking. And he told me how Wooden also told. So numerous people told me this. Now, what happened was the word was getting out around the Final Four and John Wooden couldn't keep a lid on it. So he blurted it out and told everybody the truth, which, of course, added the psychological edge to that Monday night game against Kentucky. But point being that for the rest of his life, John Wooden told something that was completely false. Now, maybe in his mind, he's conflating that, you know, he made the decision that he was going to go public.
Right.
With it as he walked off the court because he had been lying for months and he's uncomfortable with that. And now the word is getting out. Now he's got to go in and lie again. And he's like, all right, I'm done lying. But he conflated that to saying that he actually made the decision. And the other part of the Wooden story I have to say is that I did delve into the Sam Gilbert stuff, which was a huge piece of curiosity for me going in. And I felt like that story needed to be told again, toughly, but fairly and lovingly and gently. Because it was a tough spot for him to be in, but I felt like the truth needed to be told in full.
Nice. So I want to back up. You're born in Connecticut and raised in Maryland. You spent a big part of your time in Pennsylvania,
right? At summer camp.
Summer camp? I'm picturing wet, hot American summer.
Well, you're picturing correctly.
Uh-huh.
And by the way, the people who made that movie went to my wife Melissa's camp, Camp Mode in Maine. And so when I'm watching that movie with her, she was pointing out all the little references and things hanging on the walls that were references to Camp Mode. My camp is Camp Equinunk. which is where Jewish families sent their kids because they didn't want their kids at home. But they were my best memories from camp.
So my biggest question for you is why sports, why basketball and not politics? Poli sci major, your dad's in politics, or in those circles, an attorney. Why sports? Why basketball, Seth?
Great question. Well, I think it starts with why journalism. I think we have to start there. Mm-hmm. And you know, growing up, you know, obviously my dad was a big influence in this regard. For those who aren't familiar, my father is Lanny Davis. He went to Yale and Yale Law School. He was classmates at Yale Law School with Hillary Rodham. Bill Clinton was a couple of years ahead. His best friend in college was Joe Lieberman, who we don't technically have godfathers in the Jewish religion, I guess, but I call him my godfather. He was my godfather. You know what a bris is, by the way, Rex? Have you ever been to a bris?
I haven't been, but I know what a bris is.
You'd like it. You'd like it. In the sometime between the genital mutilation of the infant and all the food, a bris is a good time. So it's the father's job to hold the male child as he's being mutilated. And my father, being the huge wuss that he is, was literally hiding in the bathroom when this was going on. And so he handed me to what's called a sondek, which would be the equivalent of godfather, which was Joe Lieberman actually held.
Wow.
And I was, you know, tease him, you know, when he was a senator, he was thought to be this real hawk on defense. I always wondered where he was when I needed him, when
the
oil was coming for me. So, but, you know, Rex, I grew up in a house where, first of all, politicians were revered. Okay. People think of senators and congressmen right now. I don't think revered is the word that comes to mind, but I hope somebody ever thinks about you and talks about you the way my dad thinks and talked about John Kennedy. That was his beacon. My dad was at the March on Washington, and they all thought, and my dad actually ran for Congress a couple of times, didn't win, became an attorney, stayed very involved in politics. And then fast forward to the 1990s, his old friend Bill Clinton hired him into the White House, and he worked there as a special counsel for a year and change, sort of managing a lot of the stories through the press. And it set him up now to be a crisis management attorney. So that was kind of his journey. But my dad, also a huge sports fan, worshiped Willie Mays growing up. And he grew up in Jersey City. And his dad took him to, you know, Ebbets Field and all those, and still tells a story about Willie's final game before the Dodgers moved. Excuse me, for the Giants. I'm going to get that wrong. And my dad ran out onto the field to try to chase Willie Mays, and Willie Mays ran off the field and he got scared. He was a little kid and he thought he had lost his dad in this crowd. And he turns around, his dad's standing right there. And he says to his dad, "How'd you find me?" And his dad said, I knew where you'd be. So sports fathers and sons and families, it's a great, I experienced this with my kids where it's a constant. We were talking this morning about the Wizards and trading Westbrook for all these players and what are the Nationals going to do with Juan Soto? It's a constant bond. And so growing up, he took me to RFK Stadium in Washington, the Washington Redskins. He took me to 4 Super Bowls. I was the biggest Redskins fan you could possibly know. And I was also a ham. You know, I was the lead in the shows at Camp Equinox. And I know that shocks you.
Did you do drama and all that stuff growing up?
A little bit. Mostly like in camp, everybody was in the plays and they made me the lead because I loved it. And but I like to write. I was on the newspaper, and back in the day, of course, we got our sports news from the local newscast. That's something kids would have a hard time understanding. In Washington, it was Channel 4, Channel 7, Channel 9. And I looked at, I don't know if you remember a guy named Glenn Brenner, was the CBS sportscaster in Washington. And I looked at that, those guys, and I said, that's what I want to do, right? I mean, he's on TV, looks like he's having fun, probably making real good money.
I was watching George Michael in the sports.
Michael was Channel 4, and then Frank Herzog was Channel 7.
I changed it for the news. I just watched the sports,
man. Just the sport. Well, try to explain to people, the local news came on at 6, from 6 to 7, and at 6:37, the sports guy would come on and do his, I don't know if you remember Warner Wolf, but he had a spin in Washington as well. So I just felt like that's what I wanted to do. But I always had the writing tie-in. Our favorite movie growing up was All the President's Men, Woodward and Bernstein. So there was this romantic notion about writing and journalism. Wow. I went to Duke, even though Duke does not have journalism or communications as a major or even a school. I took a couple of classes. That's why I was a political science major, because they didn't have journalism as a major, but they had a newspaper, TV station, a radio station for students. And so I was like the only guy who wanted to do those things. So I had my run of the place. And obviously, they had a great basketball program. I was in the same
class. They were all right.
Don't yeah, they were pretty good.
They were all right. They were okay.
They were okay. In my my 4 years as an undergraduate, Duke went to 4 Final Fours. They played in 3 final games. I know you're plugging your ears. And they won it twice. So I've always thought that one day, Rex, I'm going to write a book about my undergraduate experiences at Duke. And the title is going to be I Hate Christian Laettner Too. just kidding. But I naturally fell into college basketball, getting a base of knowledge, and 2 years at the New Haven Register covering high school sports, went over to Sports Illustrated, and then I was off and running.
Well, that's I'm glad you took us to right there, because I mean, you're a young man, you're sick. And as I'm sitting here looking at you, so good looking. In fact, when they do the Rand Paul story,
that's exactly what I'm going for, Rex. Thank you. The Rand Paul story. I'm more Mitt Romney. I'm a young Romney.
Oh, you got the Duke tie-in with him. I just saw you in the good light right there for a second.
There you go. You know, Nixon went to Duke Law School, so if I got a those two, give me a minute on that.
But you're a young man at 20. I mean, you've been in sports now for what, 30, almost 30 years? Yeah. And, but
you won that.
At a time where myself and the guys you were talking about, Grant Hill and Leitner and Hurley and those guys were, you know, you almost had to play sports to be recognized like that. You've been around that long with people recognizing you. I don't even remember the first time I saw you. I just remember thinking, much like you just said, where did this guy come from? You just showed up, and then you were always had a presence on TV. You were always, and there, I know people don't really understand, there's a real gift to that. You know, you can't just get on there and monitor yourself and not get fired and then be presentable to people. Were you ever just scared shitless? I mean, really?
The only time I was scared shitless was my first segment with CBS. And it was during the 2003 Final Four. This was when Syracuse beat Kansas in the final. Remember Hakeem Warwick with the block?
Yep.
And I had been able to finagle. They had a Sunday show called the Final Two Show. It's just a studio show kind of in the bowels of the arena, hour-long show. And so I finagled my way. I had been doing some TV, and I got a segment, because the big question was North Carolina had just fired Matt Doherty.
Yep.
And they hadn't hired a coach yet. And Roy Williams had turned it down the first time when they did hire Doherty. And now he's coaching Kansas in the championship game.
Right.
And you know, what happens next? And so they brought me on to do a kind of coaching carousel spin. And I think I did say that I thought that Roy was going to take the job and that Kansas was going to hire Bill Self. I don't know what else I got right, but I know I got that right. This is actually a really neat story. So I was really nervous, and I wasn't feeling well, and I had been working real hard to get some scoops to give to CBS. And I was very fortunate that they had a rehearsal. So we did a rehearsal, and I totally bombed it. And Izzo was one of the guests in the room too. And I think everyone was kind of nervous, but I was glad to get the rehearsal on my belt. There was a security guard in the hallway. His name was Salas, right? A good old Louisiana.
Yeah.
Salas. He was great. Ah. I was just talking with him, and we were bonding, and he was keeping me calm. And so I went in for the live part, knowing that this was not just a segment for CBS, that this was a de facto. I thought it was a de facto audition. I don't know if they felt that way, but I knew it was a big moment. And right before, I turned to Salas and I said, got any last words of advice? And he said to me, just be you. Can't nobody be you better than you. And it was such a beautiful thing. You know, it was such a beautiful thing. So I did the segment. I crushed it. It went great. And they were all shocked. And I remember still teasing Izzo about this. Izzo goes, way to bounce back. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah. So, you know, I get excited when I'm on TV. I don't get nervous because, as you know from doing TV, you're so focused on like, where am I going? What am I talking about? What's coming up? What highlight? It's really like you're too focused on doing your job to think about how many people are watching. But I will say to your point, I'm unbelievably lucky that CBS, because I didn't necessarily pitch myself this way to CBS, that they saw something in me that I didn't see, which was to put me in a role that, let's be honest, almost always goes to coaches or players, mm-hmm. and that they did not feel confined by that box. And since then, you've seen, I'm not saying I did this, but I think more.
Yes,
and more
you did.
Well, I mean, like you see, like Tom Verducci, for example, was my colleague at Sports Illustrated, and he had constantly turned down TV. And I was with him at a charity golf thing that my buddy Jack McCallum always did. And we were having this conversation, and he's like, they asked me to do TV. I don't know if I want to do it. And I said, are you nuts? Look at you, you handsome devil. You should be on TV. You'd be great at it. And so, you know, sometimes people say, well, you didn't coach and you didn't play. You know, why do you feel? And my answer is, you know, if you want to hear from a former coach or former player, it's not like there's a shortage of those guys. Like, I love those guys. I listen to them. I'm friends with them. I bring my perspective, my skill set, and my experience, and I'm unbelievably lucky that CBS has, you know, supported me in doing that and built an incredible life for me. I mean, I haven't worked a day in my life, Rex, and I'm not breaking the streak on this podcast today.
Hey, man, I'm with you. And isn't it amazing, though? And you guys have just an amazing team. You work with Greg Gumbel, and you work with Clark Kellogg, who was one of my favorites. He had my favorite free throw routine of all time. Still,
really?
Yes.
I don't know that I knew this. What was his
name? Seth, he used to take the ball and dribble it, and then he would take it underhanded, throw it up to himself, catch it, and then shoot it. He did it every time. Ask him about it.
All these words.
It was a big thing in college because, you know, I mean, technically it looks kind of like a shot and you can kind of, I don't know if they let him do it while he was playing in the NBA, but But isn't it amazing it's like a family. And you talked about the pandemic and not getting to do all that stuff. And wasn't it great? I mean, speak to that for a second, just getting back in the studio, right?
Writing is a very lonely and singular endeavor. At the end of the day, mm-hmm. you and your keyboard, and I love it. I love the grind. You know, people often ask me which I like better, and my answer is TV's more fun, writing's more gratifying. But the difference is when you're on TV, you're really part of a team. And it's not just, as you well know, it's not just the guys on the set with you. That's the tip of the iceberg. Between your producers, the research guys, you know, Underdog down in Atlanta and guys like that. And that I came up as a researcher in SI, so I have a deep affinity. And the camera folks are family. You know, CBS, most of this camera crew has been there since I've been there. That's like, that's almost 20 years now. They've seen my kids always hung out. They've seen them grow up. So, but I will say this, of the countless things that I am so grateful for, the fact that I have Greg Gumbel and Clark Kellogg in my life for this many years, they are truly two of my best friends. I mean, I've spent more time with them than I have spent with a lot of my quote unquote best friends, just as the nature of the beast. And just two of the most amazing people you'd ever want to be around. You know, Clark is a really special individual, as Special K, and Greg is just hilarious and supportive, and it really, you know, I'd like to think that it really comes through on the air, that we really like each other, tease each other. That's one thing I learned early on, is you can't flip on that chemistry when the light goes on. It's got to be there all the time. It's got to be there at production meetings, in the car, back and forth in the hotel, dinner, on the road.
There's and the respect. The respect. Because, you know, it's just like, I liken it to sports because that's really my only reference. You know, I played poorly many nights. You see guys play poorly all the time. Not in my whole life have I seen anyone go out there, suit up for a game or sport of any kind, and purposely try to look bad or try to make a teammate look bad. You know, that, and there's a respect and a care that goes into those relationships, you know, because you want to, you know, might not always be your best day. And, you know, you got to have a teammate step up and help you out with a train of thought or whatever else it is.
Hey, let me tell you a quick story about Clark. My first year on the set, 2004, and he's obviously the established guy. And, you know, I started working during the season for CBS, not knowing where it was headed. I kept waiting for them to say, okay, great job last week. We're going to bring in someone else next week and you'll come back. I just didn't know. And I don't think they knew either. And then one day, Tony Petitti says to me, yeah, we're going to have you at the desk during the tournament. And I'm like this, like what desk? I thought I'd be on the road for Sports Illustrated. Next thing I know, I'm at the Final Four on the platform with Greg and Clark, just wondering how the hell this happened. But I'm the rookie. And again, I didn't play, didn't coach. So we get to the Monday night championship game and we're rehearsing our pregame segment, which is only like probably 8 minutes, like two segments wrapped around a commercial. So there's only a couple of chances for us to actually say something. And it's the biggest audience of the year. And so we are sort of rehearsing and formatting it. And the producer, Eric Mann, said to all of us, I got space for one more comment in here, but I don't have time for both of you to talk. Who wants it? And before I could say a word, Clark said, Seth can have. Now, again, Monday night.
Yeah.
Biggest audience. I'm the rookie. Didn't coach. Didn't play. He may have had no idea who I was before I sat next to him on the set. And my man says, Seth can have. And that's really all you need to know about Clark and all you need to know about how freaking lucky I am to be where I am and do what I do.
Team game. Great teammate. Team right game. There.
Great teammate.
Right?
Yeah.
All right. So you didn't have Duke in your top 10 this year, right?
I do now.
Yeah. Where do you have it? Who's winning it all, Seth? Who's the best team on the East Coast? If you had to do something right now, you can change your mind. I get it.
Okay.
Best team on the East Coast, best team on the West Coast.
Well, West Coast is easy. It's Gonzaga for me. You know, the fact that they were able to, you're not convinced.
I don't know. UCLA, I really like.
Well, I like UCLA too. But the fact that Gonzaga was able to dominate Texas without, I think Chet Holmgren finished with 2 points, I want to say, maybe 4 points, certainly wasn't a factor. Chet's going to have his moments. So that was super impressive to me. You know, UCLA is certainly right there. I'm trying to look, I'm going to call it my ballot for this week to cheat a little bit. This doesn't count as the East, but right. a team I really like and a team I am openly rooting for is Purdue. Now this is an interesting situation because again, it is possible to have too much talent. It is possible to have too many guys. Ideally, your rotation is 7 guys. Maybe 8 if nobody gets hurt. Now, if guys get hurt, obviously you need more and everyone's going to kind of go through that. So Purdue has a situation where they have this unbelievable 7'4" sophomore center, Zach Edey. Through the first 2 games, he's averaging 19 and a half points, shooting 86% from the floor. But they also have a senior who entered the draft and came back and Trevion Williams, who they can't play these guys together, Rex. So that's a little bit of figuring things out. Jaden Ivey is super talented, but now their last year's point guard, Eric Hunter, is coming off the bench. So you know, guys can say, oh, we want to win. Do you really want to win? As great a coach as Gene Katie was, I'm not sure people realize it, never made the Final Four. Yeah. So not since 1980, Purdue hasn't made a Final Four. And those fans, God bless them, they have, you know, what I call little brother syndrome, where they see Indiana down the road getting the love and Michigan down the road. Michigan's great again. Yep. But I think the world of Matt Painter, building the culture that he's built and maintaining it, even when it maybe
wasn't. I'm glad they've kept him. I really am. Yes. I know there was. Yeah.
Yeah. He's had his. And by the way, I'm old enough to remember when Jay Wright was on the hot seat. Right. Oh,
yeah, right.
And, you know, and Jay had lost a couple early in the tournament. And I use him as an example of a coach who felt like he had the support of his AD and his chancellor and his president to work his way back the right way and do it in not cut corners, not try to bring in guys and make it all work on the fly because you're afraid of getting fired. So yeah, Painter's had that. And for those fans to be rewarded with a Final Four, I am openly rooting for Purdue to make the Final Four.
Fantastic. Couple more.
Okay.
Ready? Yeah. You can reserve the right to change your mind, but you've got to make the pick right now. You need a center. Who you taking, Holmgren or Timmy?
Are we talking about for college this year?
No, for the NBA. Oh, for NBA. Your franchise.
That's easy. That's easy. Chet Holmgren is a true unicorn.
Okay.
I wonder about the physicality. You know, he's never going to be a big, strong guy.
Back in the day, I would have agreed with that, but it's different now. You know, you remember remember Sean Bradley?
Exactly.
Honey, I mean, people just, you know, it was a different time. You could be physical. And the fact that he can shoot and do all that he does, I think he's a no-brainer as well. But yeah,
I think he'll probably be between him and Paolo, I think, for the number one pick. That's a harder question for me. I was watching, by the way, this guy, Jabari Smith at Auburn. I don't know if I was watching him. I knew he was great, and mm-hmm. he had a pretty good second game, and I watched him on Synergy. He is big time. I mean, he's 6'9", made a couple threes. He's got a little that KD look mm-hmm. to him. Not as polished as Paolo, but might have a bigger upside than Paolo based on a very, very small sample size.
Wow. All right. Top five Dukies. You can only have five. Can't have more. You can only have five.
All time? Or all the
time.
Same thing
as all time. not now. Yeah. All time.
Okay. Well, I think the big three from the championship years you got to put on, right? So Grant Hill, Bobby Hurley, Christian Laettner. You know, it gets harder with the one and done guys, because I think probably the best player I might argue that I've seen come through there is Zion Williamson with everything that he was able to do. And then Jay Williams might be, my fifth guy coming out. I don't think people truly remember how great, he was as a college player. So I'm sure I'm leaving people out. Don't tell
you. No, you're leaving plenty of people.
Don't tell your boy JJ.
Johnny Dawkins out. You're leaving JJ out. You're leaving Billis out.
Oh my goodness. Billis was definitely the best screener they've ever had. So I would go with him for the best screener.
Seth.
And clear, by far the best broadcaster the school has ever produced.
He's insanely good. Like,
so good. He checks all the boxes.
Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
And nobody works harder. You know what you got to see about Jay Billis? He's got the most insane handwriting. When I was doing games for Big Ten Network, again, they let me do color. I asked him, will you send me your sheet so I could sort of learn how he prepares? He has the most perfect block text writing.
Really? It just makes me. All right.
I know he's too perfect.
He's too good. Perfect. He's got another pod where I get off the air feeling like shit about myself. Seth, thanks, buddy.
I love you, Rex. Thanks. Since Josh isn't here, do you want to do book club?
Let's do book club. What have you been up to last week? Have you read anything good?
Well, I have actually read a couple of books. I actually reread A Season on the Brink.
Yep.
Which was
Feinstein.
John Feinstein. Yep. One of the few journalism professors I had at Duke. I took his class a couple of times. Actually better. I told him this is actually better than I remembered.
Wow.
Because it's much more about that season. His insights into Bob Knight are just.
I don't know that I've ever read it.
Yeah, you'd like it. And then I'm in the middle of reading a novel right now called The Book of Longings. It's a historical novel about a young Jewish girl in the time of Jesus, and she ends up marrying Jesus and watches him go through his progression. I know it sounds probably surprising. Dana O'Neill, my colleague at The Athletic, it is unbelievably gripping and fascinating. So fiction is my escape. So.
Fantastic. Well, I didn't get around to anything this week, and that's been book club.
Okay. Well,
all right.
I appreciate that. And then wait a minute. Now you got to ask me the two questions.
Oh yeah.
I'm ready.
Thank you.
And then we have to do hold on a second now.
All right.
Well, I'm the only guest you've ever had who has listened literally to every single episode.
Must be
out of charges. I was listening to the Frank Caliendo episode. During my workout this morning, he was unbelievable. Don't even ask me the three questions I'm going to give you. First of all, this is episode 28, which to me is Daryl Green.
Fantastic.
Washington Redskins cornerback, little guy, probably the fastest athlete I've ever seen. I was in RFK Stadium the night that he chased down Tony Dorsett from behind on Monday Night Football. That's how effing old I am. So episode 28 of Thoreau Green. Yep. My movie, as you know, what's going to be my answer to my favorite movie? Do you know what it is?
I don't, but I'm going to go Hoosiers.
Hoosiers is a great guess. My favorite movie is It's a Wonderful Life, because I'm a big dumb sap, and I live tweet it every Christmas Eve. But I also want to throw out Almost Famous, Hoop Dreams, my guys, Arthur and
yes.
Moonstruck, and All the President's Men. So those are my movies. And then I have actually thought about when you asked the live show question.
Yeah, who would you see, alive or dead?
Alive or dead, who I
want to see? Front row center.
Front row center. How about peak, and I mean peak Elvis. Oof. To see Elvis in person. In a show, like I know you love Prince. I've seen Michael Jackson. I've seen Springsteen a zillion times. And maybe the other one that would come to mind is James Brown, by the way.
But just young Elvis or old Elvis, either?
I would say peak Elvis. So I would say I would say pre-Jump the Shark.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. I would say young Elvis, but established Elvis in a big setting, big arena, young. How about, you want to talk about an athlete now. How about an athlete? The way he really changed the game, not only with his music, but his performance abilities. So there you go.
Agreed. Thank you, Seth. I would have forgotten all about it. I'm down a wingman. You filled in perfect.
I know. And my thoughts with Josh, and I'm honored to be on the Rex Chapman Show. I finally made it big in this business.
Thank you, Seth Lewis Davis. Come back and do it again.
Love you. You got it.
Thanks, buddy. Well, and that was Seth Davis. What a guy. Episode 28 in the can, you guys. We're going to do another episode this week as well. I won't let the cat out of the bag. Please subscribe, rate, and review. And by the way, you know, I appreciate Seth being the biggest fan of the show and listening to all the pods and all of that. If he really respected us, he wouldn't have ruined book club by reading a book. Two, I think. Thanks, Seth. See you. Episode 29 coming up soon.